Welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program that addresses issues faced regionally and nationally from a Central Coast perspective. This program addresses the need for and consequences of change and how today's choices impact tomorrow's community. Chris Kington Barker is your host today, and she's joined by guest Valerie Farino for a discussion on the growing interest in the use of psychedelic therapy, ways it has been helpful, what you should know about it, and why and how to choose a safe and ethical facilitator. Should be an interesting conversation today, and we do encourage you to join us by calling in your questions or comments during the program. We're live in the studio today, and you can join us at 805-781-3875. And with that, let's join Chris Kington Barker and her guest. Over
to you. Thank you, Brad. My guest, Valerie Farino, end-of-life doula, psychedelic facilitator, integration facilitator, and author of Integrating Non-Ordinary States, a Handbook for Safe and Ethical Exploration, is my guest today. Since the release of Michael Pollan's How to Change Your Mind, the so-called psychedelic renaissance has gained momentum. Psychedelic have always been here. Their roles in human history aren't new. They're just being re-recognized. Valerie has been immersed in the work for over two decades and sees herself as a learner still. She's here today to share some of that learning with us. And welcome, Valerie.
Thank you. Hi, Chris.
Hey. It's good to have you here.
Thank you.
Valerie, you've been involved, and I only gave a brief intro to all of the work that you've done, but talk a little bit about those two decades of kind of immersion around this work that's kind of coming round about again and your involvement in it, and also the additional training that you've had in this, because it's not that you were starting in the 60s where we had cool tie-dye sheets up on the windows and we were kind of sitting and helping people through some kind of guided journey.
Yeah.
It's a lot more than that.
Yeah. Sure. Although I was a part of the 60s.
Yes.
Yeah. I got into this. It's actually the non-ordinary states, right? So
That's the official word.
Right. And then psychedelics came later. But I got into this when I was an early interventionist about 15, 18 years ago, and working with children and families who had addiction and intergenerational trauma. And I wanted to help them with addiction as well, and how we could help with trauma. And then the depression that they were going through, the help that they needed, and the models were not changing. They're still not changing. We need help in this paradigm of mental health.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I got into it. And psychedelic training really wasn't the thing back then. It was all about clinical studies out of Johns Hopkins. They did some at McGill up in Canada about therapeutic psilocybin for end of life. And then in the UK with Robin Carhart-Harris and Roz Watts. Both were my facilitators at school, by the way. So it was about just continuing this backdoor learning and really immersing myself into how can I do this in an ethical way and a legal way. And this was before ketamine was legal, off-label, for mm-hmm. use. So it was about studying and researching and certifying and addiction and behavior and recovery and trauma. And then I got into the end of life, and I finally became a doula, as you know, and really wanted to help people at end of life as well with these medicines. So back in 2020 and 2021, Synthesis Institute out of the Netherlands was offering a psychedelic psilocybin practitioner course, and it was a year and a half deep immersion into everything psilocybin. So I'd like to say that I have a PhD in everything psilocybin. we had the cream of the crop and facilitators. We did have Roz Watts. We had Mark Achila, who was also my mentor and my facilitator through the ICERs, which is in the back of the book of part of the resourcing. And that was all about integration. So I really went into a deep dive into what psychedelics were, how they worked on the brain, how they helped depression, trauma, anxiety, end of life. And then was certified. I needed practicum hours, so I was allowed to work with ketamine, got involved with ketamine, and worked 2.5 years at a clinic. More experience. So this is mostly, this book is based experiential and education. And it really is about informing and hopefully giving some tools about how these states come about, how they work on the brain, how to choose the right facilitator in the clinic and what to look out for. And then there are some things in the back of the book that they can use as well.
This book is, having read through the book, it's a small enough primer to, you know, really not be overwhelming.
Yeah.
So it's not like a textbook.
Yes.
And it does point to all of the different things that you talked about understanding. So that's part of what our discussion is today. And if you'd like to ask a question of Valerie, you can call us at 805-781-3875 and bring your questions into our conversation. We'd love to hear them. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, when you talk about the work that you're doing, or when you're talking about the non-ordinary states of consciousness. Mm-hmm. Define what that is.
So ordinary state of consciousness is where we are right now. I'm talking with Chris. I'm talking in a microphone. There are lights. And so it's my perception of what my reality is.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody's perceptions of reality are different. We're all looking at the same, but we don't know. So non-ordinary states is exactly what it implies. It's out of ordinary, or an altered perception of what our reality is. So, for instance, breath work, you know, we can reach a non-ordinary state of consciousness or an altered consciousness or an altered state during breath work. So there are different modalities to these non-ordinary
states. That are non-chemical.
States. Non-chemical.
Yes.
And then we'll define chemical.
Yeah, it is chemical
in
your brain
because
you alter the brain chemical.
So an outside and external substance.
Yes.
And then there are psychedelics. And before I talk about or talk to psychedelics, I'd like to say that I'm not promoting the use of an illegal substance. I really want to make sure that the listeners know that. I'm informing and I'm educating. And that's how I learned. And then again, through experience. So psychedelic substance gets you there faster. Takes years and years and years of meditation. There are some arguments about breath work as well.
Right.
Breath work, some, you know, sensory deprivation tanks, things that get us out of our way, our perception of what our way is. And these modalities, they increase the chemical BDNF on the brain. And so that is like the fertilizer or the precursor to synaptic rewiring. Okay, so psychedelics get you there a little bit faster, and it has you stay there a little bit longer, and the synaptic response lasts longer.
Mm-hmm.
Ketamine lasts for about 2 weeks, where psilocybin, they found over an animal research, lasts up to 30 days. So you've got this neuroplastic window. So that's basically what non-ordinary states are. It's just an alter of our perception and reality.
There's been a growing interest in the use of psychedelics for non-ordinary states. And with that, like anything that there's an interest in, there also is an explosion of things, of people, of professionals, non-professionals, of opportunities for those things to come along. And some of them are very legit and some are not very legit. And your book really is also cautionary about what to look for and what not to look for in pursuing those things. So why would, if someone legitimately was going to pursue a legitimate experience for a mind-altering state with a chemical, with, say, psilocybin or ketamine, what is some of the stuff that needs to be included in that? Why even consider it? What would be reasons for considering it? Is it to get high?
Sure, you could get high.
And would that be a legitimate reason to just go in and pay money and go to a clinic or go someplace to?
There have been people who just want to go in. And so some of the experiences that I've had in the clinic that I worked in, there were some people who would come in every week to fulfill an addiction. And
yeah.
They would do that. That's a cautionary tale right there. So legitimate, let me see. So depression, trauma, okay. Anxiety, people who want to get more spiritual, who want to go outside themselves, end of life. They're finding now that psilocybin and ketamine really help with existential fear and crisis around terminal illness and end of life. And so that's pretty legitimate.
Can you talk about some of the studies that have been done around end of life and some of the results with that?
Yeah. It first started with Roland Griffiths, who just died a couple of years ago, and he was at Johns Hopkins. And he found out he had, I don't remember what cancer he had. End of life. He was stage 4. And he didn't want to take a journey. And then he finally thought, you know, because he hadn't used psychedelics before. Mm-hmm. He studied them. He researched them. He did these clinical studies with other people and saw that it really helped, the psilocybin therapeutically helped with people at end of life. So he finally did it, and he said it was awe-inspiring. And he asked a couple of questions while in his journey. And one of them was, am I going to be healed? And he didn't get an answer. And he said, well, will I die? And most certainly. And then what is it? Am I going to be okay? Most certainly. The research that they did, and they're all over. I believe that Canada is doing it right now, where they're doing therapeutic end of life with psilocybin. The research is they're finding that there is a sense of peace, that dying isn't as scary, that there are questions that are answered that we most likely can't answer in our ordinary state,
mm-hmm.
That the fear, because what happens is we tend to block the things that scare us the most, right? And when we're under these states, when we're under, we'll just say psilocybin, when we have that, it takes down all the guardrails. You know, the borders are gone, and now they're cross-talking, and they're saying, look, maybe you could look at it in a different way. And so it's helped people with end of life look at their death and their life in a different way.
And is that a conversation that a person has in their own head with
yes.
themselves?
Yeah.
So the guardrails that come down are the conversations that we're afraid
yes.
to have in our own minds.
Yes.
And the answers are really coming from ourselves, because that's the
yes.
only answer that's going to soothe the soul.
That's right. Yeah.
And so it's not just the drug that makes the difference. So how important is it to have more than just the drug? Because if you're just getting the drug, is that therapeutically going to make a difference? Is that, I would imagine in some cases it may, that doorways may open for someone,
mm-hmm.
like a, you know, doorways open to a psychedelic experience for someone.
Yeah.
And there are answers. But if those doors are really harshly closed, Then what?
Yeah. So we talk about set and setting. The set is the mindset, how you're coming into these states. The setting is the environment. And that's what preparation is all about, is to prepare for what's coming. So we can talk about preparation right now.
Yeah, let me say that this is Valerie Ferrario, and she is a longtime resident of San Luis Obispo, but also an end-of-life doula and a integration specialist and author of Integrating Non-Ordinary States, a handbook for safe and ethical aspiration. We're talking about those experiences and her expertise and also her learning that she's still doing in this area. If you have a question for Valerie, please do call us at 805-781-3875. All right. Let's jump back in.
So, preparation. Preparation is just as important as anything else. So I like to call it the trifecta. Preparation, the session itself, and then integration. So preparation is the beginning of integration. It's preparing yourself to go in and ask questions. Curiosity is your best friend. So being curious about why you want to go, why you want to be under this psychedelic substance, why you want to go into this ordinary, non-ordinary state of consciousness. There's a self-check in the back of the book, you know, to go make sure that, okay, I'm checking myself. This is a good thing. Finding the right facilitator, the right place to do it in, safety first, you know, do no harm. So preparation is basically about how to prepare yourself to go in. What is going to be your anchor? What's going to help you feel safe when you're in this place where you don't know what's going to happen? You don't know. No one knows. How to
define anchor? How would I? Mm-hmm. What could I identify as my anchor?
Something familiar. You know, when we're meditating, we usually use our breath as our anchor.
Right,
find your breath, and that gets us back to center.
Okay.
So when I would prep with people going into their ketamine sessions, I would always say, bring an anchor with you, something that's familiar, something that will help ground you. I'll remind you to breathe, because when we are scared even when we're in awe, we forget to breathe. We forget. Typically, we walk around and we forget that we even have a body.
Right. So, below the throat.
Right. Yeah. We're heads on sticks most of the time, and we live in our heads all the time. So that's another thing that these psychedelics do. They get us out of our own way again. But bring an anchor. So I had someone bring in a teddy bear. Mm-hmm. I had someone else bring a ballpoint pen. It kept them safe to click because mm-hmm. that's what kept them grounded. Mm-hmm. Pajamas, pillow, whatever, a blanket, mm-hmm. you know. And they usually brought something because it helped comfort them.
Yeah.
So that's what I call an anchor.
Okay.
If they're doing it in their home, you know, sometimes people do at-home ketamine. Yeah, I won't go there. So finding that anchor, talking about how to prepare internally and externally, you know, watch what you read, watch what you ingest food-wise, because that could come up. Watch what you scroll, especially what you scroll, listen to, because these things, these are non-specific amplifiers. They'll amplify whatever is in there. And if you want to work on yourself or work on whatever that you're working on, you don't want your neighbor's drama to come in there. So really be careful who you're spending time with before you go into these states. So that's a part of preparation and a part of going in with this mindset.
That's fantastic. So with having that prep, talk about how you know that a clinician or that someone, how would you know what kind of person to go to? So if you decide that, what are reasons to go in for a non-ordinary experience?
Yeah, again, someone comes in with treatment-resistant depression or refractory depression. Okay,
so they may be referred for that?
Yes.
Okay.
So they go into a clinic, a ketamine. They want to do ketamine because that's legal. off-label. So they call the clinic itself. Then they're set up for a medical assessment, and this is to make sure that they are not taking anything that's contraindicated with ketamine, that their blood pressure isn't off the chart. Ketamine, all psychedelics raise your blood pressure and your heart rate, and it's transitory. You know, it's a very short-lived, and it'll go away. However, it does. So somebody who has a history of high blood pressure, that's really something to consider.
Mm-hmm.
Bipolar, someone who has borderline personality disorder, something that we look at and say, ooh, I think, you know, maybe we should wait on this or do more preparation. So even in prep, if I see that there are pink flags, even pink flags more than red flags with the person that I'm prepping, I always say we need to do another prep to make sure that you're ready. A lot of them come in and they think that this substance, ketamine, is the magic bullet. This is the panacea, that this is going to cure me. And I say what you said earlier, and that is the medicine is just the medicine. It's how you prepare for it, how you sit with it, and then how you integrate this medicine that's really going to be the beneficial part of it. So after we do the medical assessment and make sure that they're okay to use the substance, then we prep them and then we bring them in and then we sit with them.
So for the guide, for someone who's doing the integration facilitation, mm-hmm. When you're doing that, what are you doing with the person who's there?
Good question. So typically what happens is after we prep, I let them know what to expect, you know, what to expect when you come in. And I tell them, you know, less fluid intake because it stimulates the bladder and it has you want to feel like you need to go to the bathroom, but you really don't. So we always have them empty the bladder first. So they're not disrupted when they're in the middle of their session. You know, you mm-hmm. want to make sure that they're completely in. So it's really important for me. It may not be it's a different model for every other person, but for me, it's very important that I'm not a guide. The music is a guide and the medicine is the guide. I am more of that harm reduction specialist. You know, mm-hmm. I'm there to keep them safe mm-hmm. and to witness. And if they talk, I always ask, can I take notes? I have to have permission for that. And if they say yes, then I take notes because that's a prompt for when we do integration. So it's important for me to be there so I know more when we integrate. And because when you're in these states, you don't remember much at all,
right.
Especially on the outside world, because it's all internal now. External doesn't right. really exist. So that's essentially what we do. And we sit with them until the session is over. We make sure that they're safe. And then no driving, no operating heavy machinery to take care of themselves. One of the big questions that I have during prep is, how are you going to take care of yourself when you get home? Who's going to be your support system? You're going to need that because for 24 hours, you're still going to be experiencing what you just experienced at a lesser degree, but that medicine's still in you.
Mm-hmm.
So really surround yourself with things that are comfortable. So it's sort of like going to surgery. You know, how are you going to come in to your home and feel comfortable with the least distractions around?
So if someone is doing this treatment and going home to a traumatic situation and turmoil and things that are reactivating,
mm-hmm.
It seems counter
yeah.
to what they're trying to achieve. And part of the pre-work is, how are you going to create an environment, or how can you avoid some of these things, or can you? And have that conversation as well.
Right. So during prep, if somebody says, well, I don't know how I'm going to do this because
right.
I have X, Y, and Z that I need to do, and I will say, then maybe we should reschedule this.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes they find ways to, and I don't know what goes on when they leave that clinic.
Right.
I can't control that. I
right.
really can't control, but it makes them take pause because I say, remember that this medicine is working now, neurobiologically or neurochemically, it's working on your brain.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to start rewiring something in your brain, you want to rewire the good and not what you've already been rewired as. And that is, you know, chaos in your life. You know, the depression that you're feeling, we want to start working on maybe how we can lessen that. And by going back into that that environment that creates that, that's up to you, and this is what's happening. So really letting them know, educating, this is what happens with your brain, what's happening when the ketamine hits your system, what can happen after, and how you're fertilizing, essentially, BDNF is referred to as the fertilizer, how you're fertilizing something that, you want to fertilize it again in a good way. You want to plant good seeds.
Right. Right. It, you know, as you're talking about this, it is so inconsistent with things like people talking about or being in a situation where they are given large doses of ketamine. For instance, someone like the very public situation with Matthew Perry, who died with a ketamine overdose and was given large doses of ketamine and continued to receive ketamine with, whether that was therapeutic or not, I don't know. But it doesn't seem like there was anything that was monitoring that.
Yes, there was not. He was also taking other drugs as well, and that's a big thing. That's why we ask the person. That was... he was taking it therapeutically, I read, and he was also very addicted to it.
Yeah.
And he had, you know, he had some pretty shady people giving him these drugs.
And the point of the ketamine is not to use the ketamine for a drug that becomes a drug of addiction.
Yeah.
But it's to be a therapeutic drug that you're supporting someone while they're dealing with an issue that the drug is identified will be helpful in dealing with, like, you know, a depression that has been unrelenting with the other kinds of therapy or PTSD or, you know, other situations, correct?
Yes.
Okay. What is then your next step? We'll start with that. Well, let's take a brief break, send it over to Brad, and we'll be back in just a moment or two, about 90 seconds.
Imagine a weekend where music fills the air, nestled among the rolling hills of San Luis Obispo. It's the Live Oak Music Festival, June 13th, 14th, and 15th at El Choro Regional Park. Join us for 3 days of concerts spread across 3 stages, from bluegrass and soul to world music and Americana. And it's more than music. It's a community celebration with camping, art, and activities for all ages. Tickets are on sale now. Visit liveoakfest.org to grab yours and be a part of the magic. See you at Live Oak on Father's Day weekend.
Speaking of Live Oak, KCBX and the Live Oak Music Festival are looking for some volunteers to help us June 13th through the 15th. We've got openings for shuttle drivers, dishwashers, safety, and more. If you think you'd like to do some work in exchange for tickets, visit liveoakfest.org and fill out our handy volunteer application. Ahead today on our Thursday here on KCBX, Latino USA coming up following this program at 2. That's followed by Fresh Air at 3, then Marketplace at 4. Right now, let's return to Chris Kington Barker and her guest on Central Coast Voices. Back to you, Chris.
Thank you, Brad. My guest today is Valerie Ferrario, end-of-life doula, psychedelic facilitator, integration facilitator, and author of Integrating Non-Ordinary States, a handbook for safe and ethical exploration. That book is available on Amazon. Also, Valerie's website, if you want to get in contact with her for any direct questions specific to any kind of nature that you want to address directly with her. It is, you want to say your website?
Slow, S-L-O, mindfulrecovery.com.
Okay. And we were talking about integration. We're moving on to that. Mm-hmm. You're an integration facilitator. This is after you've decided with the person that, you know, you've done the intake, you've done, you know, you've set the scene in terms of all the information. They meet that information. You decided together that this is an experience that is right for them. They are right for the experience. And now they've had the experience. Now what?
Now comes integration. A lot of people think that they've had the experience and that's it, and they don't need to really integrate it. And I think it's very important to say that everybody needs to be integrated in something that they've never felt or seen before. It's sort of like coming into a country that you don't know anything about and you're integrating yourself to get yourself familiar. So integration turns the confusion of what you just experienced in your session to clarity. It helps clarify what you just experienced. So how does that work? So let's say, for instance, somebody had this amazing, it started off with they're going into the clouds and they're seeing relatives that they'd never seen before. So it was very awe-inspiring. It becomes very spiritual. And then all of a sudden, I'll say a purple elephant shows up with pink high heels and red lipstick. And then it becomes dark and it becomes scary. And then they come out of it and they think, what was that? What just happened? Again, that was an example. So what we do is we take that experience and I let that person interpret it. I have no desire to want to interpret what happened because it was their experience, mm-hmm. not mine. So it's sitting with them and allowing this to unfold, this experience to unfold for them. So tell me more about what you experienced. Did you feel that in your body? What did that feel like in your body? What do you think it meant? So we take these experiences and they can apply it to their day-to-day life in meaningful ways. So whatever that elephant was for them, it could have meant something for them. And then they'll say, oh, I understand the meaning. The difference between integration in the therapeutic model, meaning the psychiatry model, is, and if you have a psychiatrist or a counselor and you need that, please use them. But with integration, it's more about using the felt sense instead of the logic sense. We're not trying to make sense of the experience. We're wanting them to make it more meaningful. Mm-hmm. So we give them tools or suggestions, processing not linearly, but more of a flow. So now more art, dancing, anything of body movement, which is flow. Journaling, but journaling from feeling, not from thought. Mm-hmm. Really what's coming up for you in feelings. I even give the clients worksheets on feelings. A lot of people can't say what they're feeling, and so I give them this little cheat sheet, you know, these are feelings. So doing things that are non-linear, that are more out there, out-of-the-box thinking. Even colors, so colors come up. So sometimes when you're experiencing, you can experience synesthesia. Again, these guardrails are down on your brain,
right.
and networks are
cross-talking. The definition of synesthesia is feeling color.
Yes, exactly, mm-hmm. or hearing words. Mm-hmm. So it's just this crosstalk between these connections or these areas of our brain. So what did that feel like? You know, and if you could color, if that could be a color, what would the color be of that feeling? And that's when they would journal in that color, what you're feeling right now. So things that get them out of the box, uses different parts of the brain. Mm-hmm. Really, really important. We basically live in our left brain, back brain, you know, and especially now we're a lot in our back brain. The right brain is more of a present moment. You know, meditation is mostly in the right brain, and we want to get in that brain. We want to be in more present with where we are in proximity in space. We want to be more flow. We want to be less linear. We have all day long to be in our thoughts, but if we can get more and strengthen that right brain, we can manage what we came in for in the first place, and that is either trauma, we can manage the grip of anxiety, and we could start rewiring what is gripping us in depression and the depression symptoms.
Now, how does that work if someone is doing home therapy and they're never with somebody that's helping to ask those questions or help them to kind of draw those?
Yeah. So the model with the at home is they're assigned a practitioner.
Mm-hmm.
And so I believe that model, it includes preparation.
Okay.
They're called trochees. They send these lozenges or these trochees to the person. And then they set up a time. And so that person hopefully is watching them while they are in that state, that ketamine state. And then they can set up an integration either right after that session, or they can set up an integration session after.
So it does include integration.
I believe so. Don't quote me on that. Yeah.
Okay. And we're going to take a call from, it looks like, William. Hi, William.
Hello. I've got a question. Has any research ever been done on the effects of psychedelics on spinal cord injured people?
Say that again.
Say again, William. I'm going to turn you up.
Okay. Has any research ever been done on psychedelics influence spinal cord injured people?
How psychedelics have influenced spinal cord injury people?
Yeah. I'm not sure about the research part of it. I'm sure you could probably find something. It does help you get out of your way. I also do pain reprocessing therapy, where what it does is it helps you to lower the fear around the injury itself. So I'm sure there are some articles about that, but I can't speak to that. I can't speak to those articles or the research.
Well, in my experience, taking psychedelics orally, at least, I've never experienced any kind of psychedelia. I've had some muscle spasms, but that's about it.
Hmm. So you've never had it affect your brain?
No, it's never gotten past my injury.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Don't
have an answer for you. Sorry, William. But thank you for calling in.
Yeah, you might look into it. I'd be interested. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And if you have a question for Valerie, or if you have a comment or an answer for William, you can call us at 805-781-3875. We'd love to hear from you. If you've experienced what Valerie is talking about and you want to share something, or if you want to ask something, we'd love to hear from you. So when you're doing integration, have there been things that you've learned along the way with your integration that have been surprising to you?
Not really, no. Because everyone comes in with a different story. There's not one experience that is the same.
So they're all very different.
They're all very, very, very different. Unique. But there is a common thread. And that is how that person came out of it feeling different. I feel different. I see things in a different way, or my mood is elevated. Sometimes their mood is not elevated, yet they're finding ways that they never found before that will help elevate their mood, how they can change behaviors and perceptions around how they move about in life. Yeah.
If someone is choosing, how would they know if they've got a safe and ethical facilitation or facilitator? What should they look for? What questions should they ask?
Yeah, and there's a little questionnaire in the back of the book. What experiences that they've had? What education do they have around psychedelics?
The person that they're contacting?
Yes. Okay. Do they have resources beyond themselves? So say that there is something that they can't speak to. Can they reach out to somebody that can? What does their support system look like? Do they do informed consent, meaning do they have an intake? Do they do a collaborative consent? For instance, am I a part of this consent form, or is this just a one-sided consent form? It's really important to be a part of this. This is your experience. Mm-hmm. They are facilitating, and you want to make sure that, and where are we going to be doing it? Is my environment going to be safe? Are you going to be with me the entire time? Will I be able to reach out to you, and will you hold my hand if I have a crisis? Things like that are really, really important, because when that person goes into this environment and they don't feel safe, they're really not going to be able to just let that vulnerability come out. You know, you're going into a really vulnerable space, mm-hmm. and you got to trust that person that you're going to be sitting with.
What's the difference between this experience on ketamine and this experience on psilocybin?
Good question.
And psilocybin, besides the fact psilocybin is not legal in all states, maybe one state? Is it just one state at this point?
No, actually, Oregon for sure. They mm-hmm. actually have their clinics in there that mm-hmm. where they do therapy. Colorado is just starting, and New Mexico has just mm-hmm. been approved for this medicine. Psilocybin works on a different pathway. It works on your serotonergic pathway. So there's a lot of serotonin. Psilocybin is the same molecular structure as serotonin. So we have these receptors on in our brain and our neurons that love this medicine. And so what it does is it floods our brain. BDNF starts to be produced. And the difference here is the serotonergic pathway is psilocybin, and then the glutamatergic, which is ketamine. So when people are on antidepressants, on different antidepressants, they can go ahead and do ketamine. And that's why there was a big buzz, because a lot of people can't get off their antidepressants to do these therapeutic sessions. So psilocybin, the jury's still out. The research papers really don't talk about the challenging trips. They usually want to talk about what the benefits are and now some of the dangers that are coming up with serotonin.
So if I'm understanding you, with ketamine, someone would have to get off their antidepressants in order to start the ketamine?
With psilocybin.
With psilocybin.
Right. With ketamine, it's a different pathway. It's glutamate. So you can be on your antidepressants and still do this ketamine therapy.
Okay,
so that's a big difference between the two. The other difference is ketamine lasts about 45 minutes in the session, where psilocybin lasts between 4 to 6 hours. So it's a longer session.
Yeah.
But the effects are the same, with exception that there are some animal research done that they found that people, or the stressed out animal, had significant synaptic deficits. So that meant their dendrites, they were not firing. And so the neurotransmitters were not being received properly. But when they did these medicines, so when they did ketamine and psilocybin, they found that they had structurally that the synapses were growing. They actually found that there are little things on the spines of the dendrites that produce the synapses, that there were new, the spinal genesis, they found that there were new spines on these dendrites. So the more firing, so neurons that fire together wire together. So you're being primed. These medicines were priming your brain for neuroplasticity. And that's really the neuroplastic window. That's really where you want to start learning new behaviors, new techniques in your life. So they're the same in that way, but psilocybin lasts a little bit longer. That neuroplastic window lasts almost 30 days. Ketamine lasts up to 2 weeks.
So when you're talking about those changes in those windows, that's really the importance.
Yes.
Of the follow-up. That's the importance of the integration.
Yes.
Because, for instance, if you're going to have somebody that is using this for PTSD or using this for depression, it's during that time that maybe they're working with their therapist or they are working with a counselor, or they're working with the integration facilitator, that's when this work is taking place.
Yes.
That they're actually, while those things are firing,
yes,
you know, and mending and making connections, their brain is actually learning new behavior.
Yes, and
or allowing
yes.
new behavior, not yeah. learning it, allowing
right.
it.
Right. So I always say it's kind of like the hammer and the nail. You know, you've got a hammer and you've got a nail, but you have to have somebody using the hammer to pound
mm-hmm.
in the nail.
Mm-hmm. You are listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, your listener-supported radio. My guest today is Valerie Ferrario, end-of-life doula, psychedelic facilitator, integration facilitator. And we have about 14 minutes left or 12 minutes left in today's show. Have time for another call or two. If you have a question or you have a comment about today's topic, you can call us at 805-781-3875. A reminder that Valerie does have a website also that you can look at and write into her with specific questions, and that is?
Slow, S-L-O, mindfulrecovery.com.
Okay, great. And so we were talking about the difference between ketamine and psilocybin. Mm-hmm. Anything else?
One is synthetic and one is not. Psilocybin is a plant medicine, so it comes from the mushroom Psilocybe cubensis. So that's why they're called magic mushrooms.
Okay.
So that's the difference.
And what this is a practice that you do. I mean, you do a practice in what kinds of concerns do people come in? You said you ask people what is the question that they want to answer.
Mm-hmm.
What's the relevance of that? Is that really to help guide why they're there and what kind of work you're going to do with them around?
Mm-hmm. Again, you know, preparation is a part of integration. And I always ask them, let's start now, or I say to them, let's start now. And what would you like to work on? And then we work from there. So say someone wants to, again, I want this to help with my anxiety.
Okay.
Okay, what is that? And then we go through the feeling of anxiety, and then we do some meditation, or we do some body work, because I do a lot of somatic work. Again, we're in our heads all the time. Mm-hmm. We forget we have bodies. And both of these substances, you feel your body, even though ketamine is a dissociative. Dissociative just really means disconnected from the outside world, so derealization and depersonalization. But you're still in your body. You feel that. I'm going to go to my experience with ketamine. My first experience with ketamine, I turned into water. I didn't just see water. My whole body felt like it became liquid. So, you know, how do you integrate that? Oh, that was fun.
Yeah.
You know? So we talk about what it feels like to have anxiety in your body. And then once they go through this experience, whether with ketamine or psychedelics or psilocybin, what was that like? What did that feel like? Did you have anxiety in there? And a lot of people would report, no, I didn't feel any anxiety at all. All I felt was I was floating, or it was dark and there was nothing. You know, what was that like? So that's really where we start. We start with, what would you like to work on? And I remind them that these are not goals. These are sort of like directions. Where would you like to go? Mm-hmm. And because everything is going to change.
Yeah.
And I remind them that the medicine is going to give you what it's going to give you, not what you need, not what you want. It's just going to give you what it's going to give you.
Yeah.
And then it's up to you to work with that. And be curious. What are you giving me? Whether it's a challenging experience or a beautiful experience,
right,
or both.
Right.
What is this about? How am I going to make this meaningful in my life?
We're going to take a question from Susan. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I wanted to thank you for covering this topic today. It's just been fascinating to me for a while. Okay. And I'm curious about what the cost framework would be for treatment and the integration therapy.
Good
just
question.
So I can plan ahead.
Mm-hmm. That you would have to go to the clinic. I know that they have different costs and they have different structures. So some offer three sessions, some offer six sessions. It's up to them. And I'm quite sure that they have someone who will prep with you, and hopefully they will have someone who will integrate with you. And I'm quite sure that that's a part of that cost.
And you have a clinic here in San Luis Obispo?
I am not working at a clinic at this moment.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
But I am doing
website.
Integration on the side.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Thank you so much. This has just been really helpful today.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
What is microdosing? I keep hearing about that.
Yeah, it's a big one. So microdosing is 1/10 of a gram. So it's imperceptible as far as you don't hallucinate. There's nothing there.
Of psilocybin.
Psilocybin. You can microdose LSD, and you could do troches, which is ketamine. And you would have to talk to your provider about that, of course. So people are really into microdosing psilocybin. And what it does is it helps people focus. I don't want to say lift the veil, but it cleans the windshield off a little bit so you see more clearly. And it actually helps, again, with neurogenesis. So these dendrites, these synapses that you want to fire, is actually starting new. So these new neuronal growths help because, again, neurons that fire together wire together. And you find yourself wanting to learn more, being more creative. You're more focused in whatever you're doing. It really exploded in the Silicon Valley about, you know, a couple of decades ago when they were microdosing LSD, and it's been in the news ever since. So there are protocols around it. You could YouTube it. You can go online, and there's everything microdose. So pick and choose. But it is not a therapeutic dose. Therapeutic dose for ketamine is usually 0.75 to 0.1 milligram per 1 kilogram of body weight. And psilocybin, it depends, you know, where you want to go. Literally, where do you want to go?
Are psychedelics safe for people?
If done properly. It's like anything else. If you are not, if it's not done properly, there are dangers. There are risks behind everything that you do if you're not safe doing them.
You mentioned for people who are facing the end of life, who are maybe diagnosed with a terminal illness.
Yeah.
Is it safe for older folks?
Yes.
So if someone was in their 80s or 90s,
yes,
and are just really fearful,
yes,
is it safe for them?
I worked with two people at end of life with ketamine. And so what we did is we did a psycholytic dose, and that means a very, very, very low dose. Usually, the person who goes in usually gets between, the starter dose of ketamine is usually 30 milligrams. Then it goes up to 50, and then it depends on their weight. So for an older person, doesn't weigh as much, can't really handle it, or metabolizes it quite slowly. So that's why we did cycolytic. So little doses at a time until they got to that place where they almost reached dissociation, where they were in it. And so that's what keeps it safe. That's why prep is really important, because they just think they're going into this big dose and they're scared to death. And we say, no, we're going to start with a cycolytic dose, very low dose, 10, 15 milligrams to start. And we want you to tell us how you're feeling. And then they get into this state where now they're in there and they can actually see things that, of course, I guess the windows are open, the lens is wider, and they can see their death, or they can change a relationship with the illness that they have. So it's quite safe as long as you monitor it, and as long as you have continued conversation with the client.
Yeah. Yeah. And what if things start to go dark?
Explain what.
Well, what if things start to shift into maybe not happy visions or images or.
Yeah. We in the psychedelic world say we like challenging experiences because that's where you find the nuggets. You know, it's like James Campbell said, you know, that's the treasures are in the dark places, is in the cave. Yeah. And it's true. You know, not everything is unicorns and rainbows, yeah. And that's where a lot of the treasure happens. And it's up to us being curious around that instead of being afraid of it. And that's why integration, again, is so important, because someone who does have a challenging experience, ontological shock, right? What they thought they know doesn't apply anymore. And how do we handle that? How do I manage that? And that's what integration helps with. So that's, you know, but yeah.
And I would imagine that you need to trust the person that you're with.
Yes,
you
exactly.
You really need to trust.
Very important.
We didn't get to talking specifically about the red flags, and we have to leave, unfortunately.
Okay.
This is a big topic.
Yeah.
But I want to thank my guest today, Valerie Ferrario. Her website is slowmindfulrecovery.com. Her book is available on Amazon.com. And your book title?
Integrating Non-Ordinary States, a Handbook for Safe and Ethical Exploration.
Thank you. And next week, please join host Lotta Murty and her guests Tina Clark and Brian Atwell as they discuss mental health awareness. I'm Chris Kington Barker, and thank you for being a KCBX listener and for joining us today on Central Coast Voices.